from Pacifica. This is Democracy Now!
We're here to protest against Donald Trump. We don't want him here. We don't want him in the White House either. We think he's a danger to Israel, to the U.S., to the world. We want social justice. We want peace. Everything that Donald Trump stands against, we stand for, and vice versa. That's why we're sending a message to the Israeli people and to the American people that he's not wanted.
Palestinians across the West Bank and Gaza launch a general strike to protest President Trump's visit to Israel and Palestine. Meanwhile, Trump vowed to do whatever necessary to broker peace between Israel and the Palestinians, but offered few specifics. We'll go to Jerusalem to speak with Nathan Thrall, author of the book The Only Language They Understand, Forcing Compromise in Israel and Palestine, then to New Orleans, where the city removed the last of four Confederate statues in recent weeks.
To literally put the Confederacy on a pedestal in our most prominent places in honor is an inaccurate recitation of our full past, is an affront to our present, and it is a bad prescription for our future.
White nationalists have staged a series of protests and issued threats amidst the memorial's removals. We'll speak with Malcolm Suber, co-founder of Take 'Em Down NOLA. And in a partial victory for the Haitian American community, the Department of Homeland Security extends temporary protective status for tens of thousands of Haitians who fled their country after the devastating 2010 earthquake.
Over 50,000 Haitians, some who have been living in the U.S. for an average of 7.5 to 15 years, who have made their lives here, built their families, their homes, and businesses here, are facing deportation to Haiti. So Haiti, as we know, is not equipped and ready to absorb all these refugees.
As Haitians say the extension should be longer, we'll speak with New York City Councilmember Jumaane Williams, who represents one of the largest populations of Haitians in the United States. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Manchester, England, at least 22 people were killed in a bombing at a concert arena at the end of a performance by American pop star Ariana Grande. Dozens more were wounded in the explosion, which appears to be a suicide attack. This is 19-year-old Sebastian Diaz, who survived the blast.
Just as we were leaving after the last song, we heard the explosion when we got to the foyer doors, and we just looked behind us and it was chaos. And in front of us, people were running past the doors, screaming, looking behind them, and we were in two minds as to whether to stay in the arena and just seek shelter or run and try and get out, you know. We decided to go out, and we ran, and people were screaming around us and pushing down the stairs to go outside, and people were falling down. Girls were crying, and we saw these women being treated by paramedics that had, like, open wounds on the legs, no shoes. It was just
police
chaos.
Say they're investigating the explosion as a terrorist incident and that the alleged attacker died in the explosion. This morning on Twitter, ISIS claimed responsibility for the attack. British Prime Minister Theresa May says the police know the identity of the alleged attacker, but he or she has not been named. A second person who's also not been named has been arrested in connection with the bombing. Authorities have named the first of the 22 victims, 18-year-old Georgina Bethany Callender from Lancashire. While speaking in the town of Bethlehem in the Israeli-occupied West Bank today, President Trump condemned the Manchester bombing.
I extend my deepest condolences to those so terribly injured in this terrorist attack, and to the many killed and the families, so many families, of the victims. We stand in absolute solidarity with the people of the United Kingdom. So many young, beautiful, innocent people living and enjoying their lives murdered by evil losers in life.
That's President Trump speaking after he met with Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas in the West Bank today as part of his two-day trip to Israel and Palestine. Palestinians across the West Bank and Gaza launched a general strike Monday to protest President Trump's visit and to show solidarity with Palestinian prisoners currently on hunger strike in Israeli jails. This is Rufa Abu-Jazar in Gaza.
This protest comes as a response to the head of terrorism, Trump, and a response to whoever protects the head of terrorism, who describes the resistance of our people to defend their land and resisting against the murderers of their children as terrorism.
On Monday, President Trump sat down with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. While speaking to reporters alongside Netanyahu, Trump denied naming Israel as the source of the highly classified intelligence that he gave to Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak earlier this month, even though no one has accused Trump of naming Israel directly as the source.
Just so you understand, I never mentioned the word or the name Israel. Never mentioned it during that conversation. They were all saying I did. So you had to know the story wrong. Never mentioned the word Israel.
President Trump also implied Israel was not located in the Middle East while speaking just before meeting with the Israeli President Reuven Rivlin.
As you know, Rex, Secretary of State, has done an incredible job. We just got back from the Middle East. We just got back to Saudi Arabia. And we were treated incredibly well.
As Trump made the comment, Israeli ambassador to the United States, Ron Dermer, can be seen burying his face in his hand. Also on Monday, Trump became the first sitting U.S. president to visit the Western Wall in the old city of Jerusalem, land that was seized from the Palestinians by the Israeli military during the Six-Day War in 1967. Tonight, Trump is flying to the Vatican, where he's slated to meet with Pope Francis Wednesday. We'll have more on Trump's visit to Israel and Palestine after headlines. CNN is reporting President Trump asked the Director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats, and National Security Agency Director Michael Rogers to publicly state President Trump's campaign did not collude with Russia to allegedly influence the 2016 election. According to CNN, the request came after former FBI Director James Comey publicly confirmed in March the FBI was investigating possible collusion between the Trump campaign and Russian officials. Both Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats and National Security Agency Director Michael Rogers refused to comply with Trump's demand, which they reportedly found inappropriate. Meanwhile, former National Security Advisor General Michael Flynn says he'll invoke his Fifth Amendment rights rather than comply with a subpoena compelling him to testify to the Senate Intelligence Committee as part of an investigation into whether Trump campaign officials colluded with Russia to allegedly influence the 2016 election. Top committee lawmakers say they may hold Flynn in contempt of Congress if he pleads the Fifth, which protects citizens from being forced to incriminate themselves. During the campaign trail, Donald Trump blasted people who take the Fifth.
You see, the mob takes the Fifth. If you're innocent, why are you taking the Fifth Amendment?
Meanwhile, top Democrats on the House Oversight Committee have accused Flynn of lying to Pentagon investigators last year when he applied for a renewal of his security clearances. In a letter released Monday, the lawmakers say Flynn told the Pentagon he had not received any money from foreign companies when, in fact, only 2 months earlier, he'd received more than $45,000 in speaking fees from the Russian television network RT. It's a felony to lie to federal investigators. Flynn's also been accused of not properly registering as a lobbyist for the Turkish government last year, which is another felony. President Trump's unveiling a $4.1 trillion budget today. The plan includes massive cuts to social programs while calling for historic increases in military spending. The budget proposes to slash $800 billion from Medicaid, nearly $200 billion from nutritional assistance programs, such as food stamps and Meals on Wheels, and more than $72 billion from disability benefits. The plan would also completely eliminate some student loan programs. It would ban undocumented immigrants from receiving support through some programs for families with children, including the child care tax credit. In a rare proposed benefit for families, the budget allocates $19 billion for 6 weeks of paid parental leave for new families, a project that's been spearheaded by his daughter and senior White House advisor Ivanka Trump. The budget also calls for an historic 10% increase in military spending and another $2.6 billion to further militarize the U.S.-Mexico border, including $1.6 billion $1.6 billion to build Trump's border wall. The budget projects 3% economic growth, which economists say is widely unrealistic. Unlike previous presidents, Trump is unveiling his proposed budget while he's abroad, currently spending the day in Israel and Palestine before he heads to the Vatican tonight. David Stockman, former budget director for President Ronald Reagan, said, quote, "This budget is dead before arrival, so he might as well be out of town," unquote. In a partial victory for the Haitian American community, the Department of Homeland Security announced Monday it's extended Haitians' temporary protected status, or TPS. Tens of thousands of Haitians were given TPS after an earthquake devastated their country in 2010. The new extension will allow them to continue to legally reside and work in the U.S. for the time being. Immigrants' rights advocates cautiously welcome the decision, but voice concern DHS failed to extend TPS for the usual 18-month increment, leading some to wonder if this is a precursor to mass deportations. We'll have more on Haitians' temporary protected status later in the broadcast. In Kashmir, protests erupted today amidst news that an Indian military officer has received an award from the Indian Army after the officer reportedly ordered his soldiers to tie a Kashmiri civilian to an army jeep and parade his body through the streets the last month. Viral video of the incident shows Farooq Ahmadar strapped to the front of the moving military jeep. Army officials say the military officer decided to use the civilian's body as a human shield against Kashmiris who were throwing stones. The videos sparked widespread protests against the Indian military and demands for independence. In Colombia, major protests and strikes continue for a seventh straight day in the port city of Buenaventura, as residents demonstrate against widespread violence in the region and a lack of basic services. The government's launched an increasingly violent crackdown against protesters, killing at least one demonstrator and injuring dozens more, including children. Despite the crackdown, tens of thousands of people took to the streets of Buenaventura over the weekend. The National Afro-Colombian Peace Council says residents of the region are living through a humanitarian crisis with assassinations, kidnappings, threats, torture, the targeted killing of community leaders, and mass displacement by extraction projects in the territory. In Mexico, journalists protested Monday in the state of Michoacán to demand authorities do more to investigate the disappearance of one of their colleagues, Salvador Adame Pardo, who was kidnapped by gunmen 5 days ago. He's been a journalist for more than two decades, is currently the director of the television station 6TV. His kidnapping comes amidst a wave of murders of Mexican journalists. Back in the United States, the Supreme Court's ruled North Carolina lawmakers unconstitutionally gerrymandered two congressional districts in order to strip voting power from the African-American community. It's the latest ruling by the Supreme Court finding southern states, including Alabama and Virginia, have engaged in racial gerrymandering in order to concentrate black voters into fewer districts to weaken their voting power. And in Denver, Colorado, 33-year-old Ingrid Encalada La Torre has won a temporary stay of deportation after she sought refuge in a Quaker meeting house to avoid being deported to Peru. She's a mother of two U.S.-born children. She's been living in the Quaker meeting house since last December. This is Ingrid Encalada speaking after leaving the church on Saturday.
I think we need to continue the fight for immigration reform. It is time. President Trump has said he would work for us. It's time for the Republicans and the president to work together for immigration reform. But at the same time, we need to work here locally to ask our governor and Mayor Hancock to make Denver a sanctuary city.
Among those who came out to support Ingrid on Saturday were Jeanette Vizguera and Arturo Hernandez Garcia, two other undocumented Denver residents who both sought refuge in churches in recent years. They both won stays of deportation earlier this month. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Juan Gonzalez. Welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. We begin today's show in New Orleans, where on Friday the city removed the last of four Confederate statues in recent weeks. Hundreds of people gathered to celebrate as the massive bronze statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee came down. It was the first of a series of monuments to be removed during daylight. Workers wore bulletproof vests and face coverings to conceal their identities as they used a crane to remove the statue from his 60-foot-high pedestal. New Orleans Mayor Mitch Landrieu said threats and intimidation necessitated the overnight work and extra safety precautions. Afterward, Landrieu delivered an address about the city's efforts to remove the monuments that he says celebrate the lost cause of the Confederacy.
The historic record is clear. Robert E. Lee, Jeff Davis, PGT Beauregard statues were not erected to just honor these men, but as part of a movement which became known as the Cult of the Lost Cause. This cult had one goal and one goal only, through monuments and through other means, to rewrite history, to hide the truth, which is that the Confederacy was on the wrong side of humanity. First erected 166 years after the founding of our cities, 19 years after the Civil War, these monuments that we took down were meant to rebrand the history of our city and the ideals of the Confederacy. These statues are not just stone and metal. They're not just innocent remembrances of a benign history. These monuments celebrate a fictional, sanitized Confederacy, ignoring the death, ignoring the enslavement, ignoring the terror that it actually stood for. And after the Civil War, these monuments were part of that terrorism, as much as burning a cross on someone's lawn. They were erected purposefully to send a strong message to all who walked in the shadows about who was still in charge in this city.
White nationalists have staged a series of protests and issued threats in the lead-up to the memorial's removals. A car belonging to one of the workers had also been set on fire. Though the four most prominent Confederate monuments have been removed, activists are calling for New Orleans officials to remove all monuments, school names, and street signs in New Orleans dedicated to white supremacists. Well, for more, we go to New Orleans, where we're joined by Malcolm Suber, co-founder and coordinator with Take 'Em Down NOLA. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Malcolm. Can you talk about the history of the Take 'Em Down movement and your reaction to these four statues being taken down?
Yes. Well, you know, first of all, Take 'Em Down NOLA is a continuation of the decades-long struggle of Black people in the city to rid ourselves of the presence of these white supremacy monuments. Take 'Em Down NOLA was founded 2.5 years ago, and in the wake of the Bree Newsom taking down of the Confederate flag in South Carolina, and the shootings in Charleston. And we felt that it was necessary for us to come together and really press the city to step up its efforts or renew our efforts to get rid of these white supremacy monuments. And so just coincidentally, the mayor announced that he wanted to get rid of four statues around the same time. And from the very beginning, our position was, we are not satisfied with you just saying that there will, the mayor saying that there would only be four statues removed, when we knew, due to our historical research, that there were more than 20 Confederate statues, hundreds of street names, and 30 school names. So in all, there was 130 or 40 Confederate memorials in the city that needed to be removed. And so our position with the mayor has been, if you truly believe that these Confederate memorials are here to terrorize and to remind Black people about who is in charge in the city, then you should expand your reach. And as far as we're concerned, we of course, welcome these four being down, but we've got plenty of work to do, and we're asking the mayor to join us in this effort rather than ask us to be satisfied with these four.
And Malcolm Suber, your reaction to the Louisiana House just passed a bill that would make it more difficult to remove any monuments honoring war heroes, including Confederate monuments. Your reaction to those actions of the legislature and also the threats that have come for against the city just for those few monuments that have been removed?
Well, you know, we think, of course, the whole history of white supremacist organizations in the South has been one of terrorism. And so even though they don't march in the streets with sheets any longer, they have organized themselves and are still issuing all kinds of threats against myself, against the city officials and everybody else who they can think of. But again, history proceeds, and we are not afraid to challenge these white supremacist institutions. And of course, a real reflection of how bad race relations are in the state of Louisiana and in New Orleans is that every white legislator in the Louisiana House of Representatives voted last Monday to require a popular vote to have any of these Confederate statues removed, especially of any soldier, including those who were traitors who fought in the Confederate Army. So that, of course, revealed that their true position was to support white supremacy. And as a result of that, all 23 of the black representatives walked out after the vote and rightly and justifiably called this another white supremacist assault against black people in this state.
I want to turn back to New Orleans Mayor Mitch Landrieu speaking last week about the efforts to remove the four monuments to the Confederacy.
We forget, we deny how much we really depend on each other, how much we really need each other. We justify our silence and inaction by manufacturing noble causes that marinate in historic denial. We still find a way to say, wait, wait, wait. Not so fast. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said, wait has almost always meant never. We cannot wait any longer. We need to change. And we need to change now. No more waiting. This is not just about statutes. This is about attitudes. And it's about behaviors as well. If we take down these statutes and don't change to become a more open and inclusive society, then all of this would have been in vain.
Malcolm Suber, if you can respond to the mayor of New Orleans.
Well, of course, we say if you really do believe, Mayor Landrieu, if you really do believe that we can't wait and we should get rid of all these statues, then you've got to extend that reach to get rid of all of them. Let's go forward with a clean slate. Let's get rid of all the Confederate street names, all the Confederate names on our schools, and the rest of the Confederate statues. We just believe there's some inconsistency in the mayor's position. If he really believes what he says and is not just putting words out for public consumption, then he should join, take him down NOLA, and put a timetable as to when we will get all these things done. And then we can celebrate and go forward and talk about beginning to really address the many problems of the black community here, including 50% male unemployment, including 50% of our children live in poverty. And, of course, New Orleans is the most incarcerated place in the entire world.
I wanted to ask you about the lieutenant, your lieutenant governor, Billy Nungesser, who's asked—
Nungesser.
Who's asked New Orleans Mayor Mitch Landrieu to turn over the Confederate monuments to his office. He met with Landrieu, but city officials said the state would have to submit their proposals for acquiring the monuments along with any other interested groups. This is the lieutenant governor speaking on Monday.
I just want to do the right thing with them, and I think dragging this thing out is not to the better. It's not helping tourism, it's not helping the city, and it's surely not helping the state. So I think the people that are passionate about preserving history are those people want to feel comfortable that they're going to not sit in a yard somewhere or not be put back up where visitors from all over the world can come see the history of Louisiana, and that's what we're hoping for.
That was Lieutenant Governor Nungesser. Your response to him?
Well, Billy Nungesser is a white supremacist, believes in white supremacy, and we don't believe, we don't take seriously his argument that tourists come to New Orleans to bathe themselves in white supremacy. People come to New Orleans to enjoy the vibrancy of our city, its food, its culture. And very few people come here out of any love or desire to learn about the history of the enslavement of African people and the oppression of African people in the Jim Crow era. So we think these are all thinly veiled arguments to support white supremacy. And our position in Take 'Em Down NOLA is that not only should these things be removed, but they should be destroyed. We don't think that they should be on public display in any context, because, like the mayor said, these things were put up purposely to celebrate white supremacy and the oppression of another people. And we don't think that the city should be going forward, getting ready to celebrate its 300th birthday, that it should be going forward with a clean slate, getting rid of all Confederate monuments.
I want to turn to Brian Stevenson, executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative, speaking about the findings of their 2015 report, Lynching in America, Confronting the Legacy of Racial Terror. He called for the placement of historical markers at sites where lynchings occurred.
The idea that racial difference can make you a target of violence and terrorism is something that we've been dealing with for a very long time, and I think we just haven't really talked about it. And one of the things we want to do by erecting these markers and monuments is to get communities to begin to reflect more soberly on what this history represents. You go to Germany now and you are forced to deal with the legacy of the Holocaust because there are markers and monuments everywhere. We do the opposite in this country. We celebrate the things, in my judgment, that we probably shouldn't be celebrating. In all of these states, you find Confederate memorials and monuments everywhere dedicated to the people who were defending slavery, trying to preserve slavery, and yet nothing about the pain and anguish and suffering and injustice that those institutions created.
So that was Brian Stevenson of Equal Justice Initiative. He was speaking to us from Montgomery, Alabama, on Democracy Now! Malcolm Suber, your response to what Brian is saying?
We agree completely with what Brian is saying. You know, these memorials all across the South, in every courthouse and every county throughout the South, they've got a Confederate soldier's monument. And they don't teach our kids in schools that these people were indeed traitors. And, of course, the United States made some fundamental errors after Reconstruction. The first of all, the battle flags and these traitors should not have been allowed to participate in the politics of this country. And because of that legacy, instead of doing as they have done in Germany and outlawing all these things that are reminders of enslavement of African people, they celebrate it. And as long as they celebrate it, they won't ever understand that these things are daily insults to African people and to our allies, and that they must be gotten rid of if we're going to move forward on the basis of freedom and equality.
Malcolm Suber, we want to thank you for being with us, co-founder and coordinator with Take 'Em Down NOLA. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we go to Jerusalem. Stay with us.
Don't worry, this face. Hold my hand in her. Of this place, it's for me and you only. Softly, softly know me. Tear in this face. Hold my hand in air. Daughter of this place, it's for me and you only.
Ultraviolet, FKA Twigs, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
ISIS has claimed responsibility for an attack on a concert arena in Manchester, England, Monday night that killed 22 people. Meanwhile, President Trump has arrived in Bethlehem as he continues his two-day visit to Israel as part of his first trip abroad as president. On Monday, Trump placed a note in the ancient stones of Jerusalem's Western Wall and met Israeli leaders. He vowed to do whatever is necessary to broker peace between Israelis and the Palestinians and called a peace accord the ultimate deal, but offered few specifics.
I believe that a new level of partnership is possible and will happen, one that will bring greater safety to this region, greater security to the United States, and greater prosperity to the world. This includes a renewed effort at peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians. And I thank the Prime Minister for his commitment to pursuing the peace process. He's working very hard at it. It's not easy. I've heard it's one of the toughest deals of all, but I have a feeling that we're going to get there eventually. I hope.
During a meeting with Israeli leaders, Trump appeared to generate discomfort in the room when he mentioned his stop in Saudi Arabia and implied Israel is not located in the Middle East.
As you know, Rex, Secretary of State, has done an incredible job. We just got back from the Middle East. We just got back to Saudi Arabia, and we were treated incredibly well.
As Trump made the comment, Israeli Ambassador to the United States, Ron Dermer, can be seen burying his face in his hand. During his remarks, Trump said he also saw the possibility of a new alignment of Muslim nations and Israel against Iran.
These leaders voice concerns we all share about ISIS, about Iran's rising ambitions and rolling back its gains, and about the menace of extremism that has spread through too many parts of the Muslim world. I'm encouraged that they pledge cooperation to confront terrorism and the hateful ideology that drives it so hard.
During his appearance alongside Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu Monday, Trump also pushed back against reports he disclosed highly classified information to the Russians during his Oval Office meeting with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak.
Just so you understand, I never mentioned the word or the name Israel. Never mentioned it during that conversation. They were all saying I did. So you had to know the story wrong. Never mentioned the word Israel.
The New York Times reported the information that Trump had passed along had come to the United States from Israel, but it did not allege that he mentioned the word Israel during the meeting. All this comes as Palestinians across the West Bank and Gaza launched a general strike Monday to protest Trump's visit to Israel and Palestine and to show solidarity with Palestinian hunger strikers in Israeli jails. This is Rifa Abu-Jazar in Gaza.
This protest comes as a response to the head of terrorism, Trump, and a response to whoever protects the head of terrorism, who describes the resistance of our people to defend their land and resisting against the murderers of their children as terrorism.
For more, we go to Jerusalem, where we're joined by Nathan Thrall, senior analyst at the International Crisis Group covering Gaza, West Bank and Israel. His new book is titled The Only Language They Understand, Forcing Compromise in Israel and Palestine. Nathan Thrall, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you talk about the significance of President Trump's trip to both Israel and the occupied territories, and talk about what he has said so far and the response?
Well, the trip so far, and it's just ended, is not all that significant. I mean, the real significance is anticipating whether he's going to attempt to start a peace process, whether he's going to attempt to start a peace process with the regional states, with the Sunni Arab states that he just visited in Riyadh. And it appears that he does intend to do so, and it appears that the parties, both Israelis and the Palestinians, are keen not to upset him and will probably go along with at least starting a process. That hasn't been trivial for previous administrations to do. Of course, if he starts a process, that's by no means a guarantee that he's actually going to conclude one successfully. And I think both sides are counting on The notion that he is easily distracted, and when he faces obstacles, as he inevitably will, he'll just move on to the next thing. So I think that what we're facing right now is great uncertainty on both sides with respect to Trump, which both sides both regard as a threat and an opportunity. There's a sense that there's real ignorance, both on the part of the president and the team around him, and so much so that each side could potentially take advantage of that ignorance and change or shift U.S. policy in their direction. So everybody's walking on eggshells right now and trying very much not to upset Trump, very uncertain whether he's capable of retaliating against one side if he feels that they are an obstacle to his achieving what appears to be a real priority for him. And the real priority for both sides is to try and stay on Trump's good side for now without doing anything that's too domestically difficult for each one.
Nathan Thrall, I wanted to ask you, clearly Trump is not a conventional American leader as far as the foreign policy establishment is concerned, but you suggested in some of your writings that he's treating the Israeli-Palestinian question as basically a real estate deal, a real estate transaction. Could you talk about that?
Sure. I mean, there's a sense that Trump is not at all beholden to the views of the U.S. foreign policy establishment, really on anything, but especially on this conflict. And there's a sense that he does look at this as a real estate transaction. He has a bold subheading inside his book, The Art of the Deal, that's called Use Your Leverage. And that's really the locus of the fear on the Israeli side with respect to Trump. It's the notion that he could really try and exert pressure on Israel, threaten real consequences in the U.S.-Israeli relationship if Israel were not to agree to, let's say, the outlines of an American proposal for a settlement of the conflict or the outlines of an American proposal on which the two sides would negotiate. And work out the details. And Trump has, you know, during his campaign, he said some things that were frightening to supporters of Israel. He refused to blame one side for the impasse, and he even refused to back down when he was criticized for refusing to do so. And he does appear to really prioritize this conflict and see it as something that could create a legacy for him. And so the question is, does he intend to use his leverage? Is he capable of using his leverage? And if he is, then we're looking at a totally different Israeli-Palestinian peace process than we've seen in the past.
Nathan Thrall, can you talk about who Ronald Lauder is and what his relationship with Donald Trump is around Israel and Palestine?
There's been a lot of reporting about Ronald Lauder's influence over Trump. They've known each other for a long time. Ronald Lauder is a very wealthy American businessman, and he had in the past been close to Netanyahu, although they are estranged now. He had been an envoy for Netanyahu in the 90s in negotiating when Netanyahu was prime minister then, in negotiating with Syria. By many accounts, he was not a very good one. And at this point, he is said to be very influential over Trump on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. For a couple of years now, he's been going around the region trying to promote his own peacemaking initiative. The people who have looked at this plan have ridiculed it as being ignorant of kind of the basics of the conflict. But that's the administration that we're dealing with. Trump has a personal relationship with this man, and he has a plan, and he has a team, and he appears to be telling, if the reporting is correct, he appears to be telling Trump that the Palestinians are ready and willing to make a deal, and that Netanyahu is probably the obstacle. Again, that's if the reporting is correct. I'm not inside the room to tell you for sure whether that's the case. But if so, I think that's very troubling to the Israelis. At the same time, there are real limits on how much of a role Lauder can play if Netanyahu refuses to deal with him.
In a recent article you wrote for The Guardian, you said, and I'm quoting, the real explanation for the past decades of failed peace negotiations is not mistaken tactics or imperfect circumstances, but that no strategy can succeed if it is premised on Israel behaving irrationally. What did you mean by that?
Well, what I meant by that is that in the past, U.S. administrations have had a notion that both sides really want an agreement, and it just takes, you know, a bit of American facilitation to bring them together and to convince, in particular, to convince Israel that it's in its own self-interest to reach peace, because if they don't, then they're going to become a pariah state and be forced by the entire world to give citizenship to all Palestinians. That's this very stark choice that Israel is imminently going to face, and so clearly it's in its rational interest to avoid doing that. The whole purpose of Zionism is to have a state for the Jewish people. They'll lose that if they give citizenship to all Palestinians. And this is the conventional wisdom among American commentators and inside the U.S. government. But the fact is that it's not a matter of just convincing Israel of its rational self-interest, because it's not actually in Israel's rational self-interest to make an agreement and to give the Palestinians a state today. It may be in the future when circumstances change. But today, any prime minister would be crazy to make peace with the Palestinians now without being forced to. Even if they knew for a fact that in the future they were going to be forced to make a deal, they have every interest in waiting until that day comes, seeing if that day comes. Today, they're enjoying security quiet from the Palestinians in the West Bank. They've enjoyed years of this security quiet in the West Bank. And they have full security control. Their forces are on the border with Jordan, and they have very little to gain when they're going to pull out tens of thousands of their own citizens, cause enormous domestic upheaval. And you have polls that show a majority of Israelis are opposed to giving up sovereignty over the Temple Mount or Haram al-Sharif, and that would be a necessary component of any agreement. So basically, what you're talking about is an Israeli prime minister who has to say to himself, "I'm ready to end my political career, create the worst domestic turmoil this country has ever seen, face potential assassination, and all for what? What am I avoiding by doing that? If I take the other path and I just don't do the deal, what do I face? I face a very comfortable situation that I have today."
Nathan Thrall, what about the Palestinian hunger strike, this major strike that's going on in Israeli jails? Talk about what it's about and its connection to Trump's visit right now.
So the hunger strike is primarily led by the Fatah faction, and although other factions are participating in it. And it's now in its 37th day. The demands of the hunger strikers is to improve the conditions of prisoners. There's a list of 14 demands that they have, but the most important of them is to end administrative detention, to end solitary confinement, to improve health conditions in the prisons. And the effect of this, I hope you can hear me with the helicopters overhead. The effect of this is really to create a problem for the Palestinian leadership, which is trying to promote a process with Trump, trying to be on Trump's good side, and is talking about something that's totally disconnected from what most Palestinians care about today, which is the hunger strike that is overwhelmingly supported by Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. A huge proportion of Palestinian families, nearly all of them have relatives who are in prison. They're all extremely supportive of this hunger strike, extremely concerned about the hunger strikers. These people are now receiving medical attention and being pulled out of the prisons into medical facilities. And at the same time, there's this very incongruous image of their president sitting and meeting with Trump, who's not hasn't said too many things that ought to make Palestinians happy. And talking about engaging in yet another round of negotiations, vowing that there will not be an imposed solution, meaning, of course, that the United States won't put pressure on Israel. So there's already extreme skepticism that any of this effort at restarting negotiations would succeed. But to have this take place while Palestinians are concerned about something so pressing as the lives of these prisoners really makes it quite tough for the Palestinian leadership.
And finally, Nathan, the impact of what's happened in Manchester at the Ariana Grande concert, where at least 22 people, a concert really that just attracted tweens, very young teenagers, the impact it has with ISIS now claiming responsibility on, well, the area where you are, on Israel and Palestine.
Well, the primary impact, I think, is that it makes things harder for the Palestinians, because this news was then used to highlight the issue of Palestinian terrorism and the issue of payments to families of Palestinians who have fought against Israel and been killed or imprisoned. That's a big issue in the United States, and it was re-raised now in part because of this attack. It's also the case that the Palestinians feel that they have very little to offer the United States, and they're trying to see what they can do to be in Trump's good graces and to try and persuade him to actually press for a deal. And so one of the few things that they can say is, well, we're providing security for Israel. Israel's own security commanders are complimenting us on the great job we're doing. We've been doing it for years. There's no state coming. And so they've tried to emphasize their own value in countering extremism in the region, that they will be part of this coalition of Sunni states with the United States in fighting ISIS, and stressing the importance to the United States of supporting the moderate Palestinian leadership.
Well, Nathan Thrall, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Senior analyst at the International Crisis Group covering Gaza, West Bank, Israel. His new book is titled The Only Language They Understand, Forcing Compromise in Israel and Palestine. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Hummus, salad. Chips, בצד בנסבי איקום הדה הוא דו קיום אחים אני מעביד במסעדה עשרה מבניי פשעת דו קיום באלה ביום דימוגרפי Indiani, Arabi Masriya, Ma'ay Bagrut, Ghanuli Ahmad, Arabi Ftatiya. لما نقرا كل ستيكر تاعكم بدحاربه فانا بكتب بالعربي بتمنعوني من الراديو لزقت ستيكر جديد على الشباك احمد فرلوم احمد انا مش بوليتي انا مش بوليتي انا مش بوليتي
I Am Not Political by Palestinian hip-hop artist Tamer Nafar. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, in a partial victory for the Haitian American community, the Department of Homeland Security announced Monday it has extended Haitians' temporary protected status, or TPS. Tens of thousands of Haitians were given TPS after an earthquake devastated their country in 2010. And the new extension will allow them to continue to legally reside and work in the U.S. for the time being. Immigrant rights advocates cautiously welcomed the decision, but voiced concern that the Department of Homeland Security failed to extend TPS for the usual 18-month increment, leading some to wonder if this is a precursor to mass deportations. The Haitian Advocacy Working Group tweeted, quote, Haitian hashtag TPS extended for 6 months by Trump administration, but decision foretaste upcoming trouble, hashtag deportation. On the campaign trail in September, Donald Trump visited Little Haiti in Miami and vowed to be a champion for the Haitian American community.
Whether you vote for me or you don't vote for me, I really want to be your greatest champion, and I will be your champion, whether you vote for me or not.
That was candidate Donald Trump speaking last year in Little Haiti in Florida. If the Trump administration refuses to extend TPS after the six-month reprieve expires, up to 55,000 Haitians could be forcefully repatriated to their fragile, struggling homeland. Last month, the acting director of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, James McCammont, wrote a letter to Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly suggesting the Haitians should be deported as early as January. In the letter, McCammont said conditions in Haiti have improved considerably. His conclusion and recommendation contradicts an assessment done by the Obama administration in December. Under Obama, the State Department examined the same circumstances and recommended the Haitians be allowed to remain in the United States. Human rights advocates note Haiti is still reeling from Hurricane Matthew, which in October 2016 destroyed the country's southwest peninsula. The hurricane killed more than 1,000 people and decimated villages and farmland. Haiti's also suffering from a devastating cholera epidemic that erupted after the earthquake. Well, for more, we're joined by Jumaane Williams, New York City Council member for District 45. His district represents one of the largest populations of Haitians in the country, in Brooklyn. Welcome back to Democracy Now.
Thanks for having
Councilman
me
Williams, your response to this, yes, it was a stay of deportation or an extended of TPS extension of TPS status, but not all that the Haitians were requesting.
Well, you know, I think the expectations of this administration are so low that we have to say, okay, we got something. But in any other circumstances, we really didn't. We expected and hoped to get a lot more. Truth be told, we had concerns under the Obama administration. I don't want people to think we didn't have concerns then. But at least when it came through, it was 18 months. You don't know what to expect. I call him the orange man, with these type of things. And so I'm happy that it's 6 months. But what does that really do when you have to live with a cloud over your head? I think this is really an extension of the assault on immigrant communities and the lack of recognizing the humanity of people. If they need to get a job, and you say you may leave in 6 months, that's hard. You want people to kind of live their life comfortably with their family, but you have a cloud over your head. That's a difficult thing to do. And I don't think anyone that has any real sense of intelligence of what's going on in Haiti, whether it's the earthquake, cholera, or the hurricane, can say it's ready to accept people back right now.
Well, what about that situation? What is the situation now, especially after the hurricane, the most recent major devastation there?
Sure. So you remember the pre-earthquake, Haiti was not in a position to be as prosperous as it could have been or should have been. That's a long history that we should discuss one day. Then the earthquake hit, and then cholera. Many believe the U.N. brought cholera with them. And then the hurricane. And so many of the celebrities and the cameras have left. But the devastation still exists, and there's not a lot that has been done to address those things the way we'd want. And so even though a lot of people have sent money, that's another story itself where the money has gone. But it's in no way ready to receive the people who left for those same reasons. Just imagine it's been exacerbated by those things that we mentioned after the earthquake.
Some people are saying that this extension of 6 months instead of the typical 18 months is a chance to for Haitians to get their affairs in order.
It's a concern. Again, I believe this is just an assault on the immigrant communities, particularly black and brown immigrant communities. 18 months is the usual what we expect. 6 months, maybe people Say it again.
Your area, Flatbush, can you describe it
for us? Oh, absolutely. I represent, combined with the 40th District, we represent the largest constituency of Haitian and Haitian Americans outside of Haiti. Some argue Florida. I think we have Florida beat. So we have a huge constituency of folks who are very concerned. There's 20,000 people across the state. I think a large portion of them are in my district. They're already are dealing with kind of mass hysteria around immigration policies in general. And now if you're Haitian, or you have Haitian family with TPS, imagine that concern now. And so how do you deal? People talk about public safety. How do you deal with those concerns when you have a community that's reeling about what's really going to happen with immigration in general? What's going to happen? I may be deported in 6 months. Do I have to go underground? Do I have to do this? Do I have to do that? And you're going to send them back to a country who really is not ready to receive them. There's no one with any kind of consciousness that can say Haiti is ready to receive 60,000 people. And the truth is, I don't believe that this country can deport 60,000 people, just like I don't believe they can deport millions of people. But what they can do is continue this kind of mass hysteria that I think benefits this country in a way that's another type of discussion, to keep folks in kind of a second-class position for themselves while benefiting from all the services and talents that they bring.
I wanted to change the topic slightly on another issue that you've been dealing with in city council, which is the soon-to-be-coming annual Puerto Rican Day parade.
Sure.
There's been a lot of controversy raised over the fact that the parade leaders have decided to honor Oscar Lopez Rivera, who just was released from prison after more than three decades in prison by President Obama. And I wanted to get your sense, because I know the city council has had to take a stand now that some companies have said they're not going to participate in the parade, and now that the police chief of New York City has said he will not participate in the parade either.
Well, that's not a slight change. It's a complete change in discussion. But I plan on being there. I wasn't planning until I started getting tweets asking me not to go. I was proud to support the speaker and her support of Oscar Lopez. It's always interesting to me. One, he hasn't been associated with any violent acts. But it's always interesting to me that people believe when folks are fighting for their freedoms or fighting for equity and justice, that they can just write a letter asking for those things and they're just given to them. There has been no social justice, no equity, no freedoms given anywhere in this world, I think, in time immemorial, that hasn't been given or taken without some kind of pressures. And we celebrate those things when we look back. But during the time period, we pretend as if people are crazy and don't know what they're talking about.
In the significance, Juan, for people aren't familiar with Oscar Lopez Rivera's case of him coming to New York.
Well, the significance, he just was released about a week ago, finally, from home detention after being released from prison and then sent into detention in Puerto Rico, and he immediately went to Chicago, his hometown, where he was welcomed as a hero.
Congress members and all were there.
Yeah, all of the—many of the Latino elected officials. And now, of course, the Puerto Rican Day Parade, which is in 2 weeks, is the largest gathering of Puerto Ricans in the United States. The significance of him coming to New York City after spending more than 30 years in prison. There's clearly a lot of controversy. There were more people who were in favor of him being freed from prison, even if they didn't agree with his beliefs, than are saying that he should be welcomed as a hero. But still, the decision of the parade committee is it an opportunity for the people to have free speech.
And you shouldn't be telling people who their heroes should or shouldn't be. Again, he himself was never associated with any violence. And don't forget, Nelson Mandela was listed as a terrorist well into the 20th century. So there's a big—depending on which side you sit, usually if you're on the side with the power and privilege, you kind of view these things a little differently.
Well, we want to thank you, Jumaane Williams, for being with us, New York City Council member for District 45 in Brooklyn. His district of Flatbush, East Flatbush, represents the—well, he says the largest population of Haitians in this country. And a final correction from our headlines, where we reported on another undocumented mother winning a temporary stay of deportation after seeking sanctuary in a church. The speaker in the clip we've played was actually undocumented mother and activist Jeanette Vizguera, not Ingrid Encalada. Again, Ingrid Encalada was granted a temporary stay of deportation last week after she sought sanctuary in a Quaker meeting house in Denver. Jeanette Vizguera also won a stay of her deportation earlier this last month after she took sanctuary in a Unitarian church in Denver. And that does it for our show. A very happy birthday to Mike DeFilippo and a belated happy birthday to Samin Farhadeh. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nimreen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gadasdiner, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Tarina Nadura, Andre Lewis, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Paul Huckabee, our engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.